Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of American Criminal. In our latest season, the child of Italian immigrants sets out to achieve the American dream. And if he has to spill some blood along the way, so be it. Listen to American Criminal, Al Capone, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get ad-free access to the entire season first, subscribe at IntoHistory.com.
Welcome to the OC Bitches.
Welcome to the OC Bitches. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Melinda?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm doing really, 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 really well. And I've been waiting for our guest for a while on this podcast that we are all coming to love doing and love reconnecting with people. And if we didn't do this podcast, I don't know that I'd be able to have this conversation with all of these cool people that we're having conversations with. So why don't I actually introduce, we are doing episode 24, The Proposal, and we are so pleased and excited to welcome our guest today. Born in New Zealand, this fine actor of stage and screen has been in pretty much everything. I mean, from over 1,100 episodes of the Australian drama Neighbours to ER, X-Files, Ugly Betty, Lost, Entourage, Once Upon a Time, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, The Girl and the Dragon Tattoo. Oh my gosh, I love this one. Spam-a-lot. And for the past four seasons, Dynasty. You all know him as Caleb Nichol, or Cal to Julie, Dad to Kirsten, Grandpa to Seth, and one half of the gruesome twosome to Sandy. Welcome, Alan Dale.
Production, thank you very much. Production.
I have so much fun
it
doing this.
It is so
these.
Nice yeah. to see. Yeah, yeah, he's really great with introductions. Yeah. I have to give it up to Melinda. Yeah. But it's so nice to see you, Alan. Thank you for
My
coming
pleasure,
on
Rachel.
And being here with us.
My pleasure, Rachel.
And also, you're sitting in a very cool-looking house, I have to say.
Yeah, it's an odd thing that happened when we first came over here to do the pilot. It was freezing cold. It was March. And I thought, oh, fancy having to live here. And I thought, it's okay. We're just doing a pilot for a remake of Dynasty. No one's going to want it, so we'll be right. But then they picked it up. And I rented a house on the lake, which was very clever, except it was a long way away and I have an electric car, so that became a problem. I got very lonely sitting out there by the lake. And then one day this house came up for sale on Zillow, I think it was, and I just loved it, so we bought it.
It's very cool looking, so
Well, it's available. I've just finished on Dynasty, so we're going to rent it out. It's got everything.
Yeah.
So,
really?
Yeah, so if you're working over here,
yeah, Atlanta is one of those cities that you really have to drive everywhere. It's not like you can take, locations can be very far distance. And when you purchase a home there, I think they're usually tend to be in the suburbs.
Yeah, only this is Midtown. It's a funny thing. Yeah, which is right near the High Museum and things. And it's quite an arty place.
Oh, really?
Who would have thought? There you are.
Yeah. Well, so you've been working on Dynasty.
I have.
For four seasons, right?
Four seasons, yes. In fact, you know, when I was working on the OC, the thing that I didn't think when I left my home in New Zealand and came to America via Australia, that I'd end up living within a mile of my studio. I thought I was coming to Hollywood. But in the end, you know, one time Trace borrowed the car for the day and she forgot to pick me up. So I walked home, you know, it was only a mile. So, yeah. But ever since then, I've been in Cape Town and here and Vancouver and, you know what it's like. You know, so we were very spoiled when we were doing the OC.
Well, so you lived in Manhattan Beach before we started shooting the OC. So you were, which is exactly where our studio was. And that is definitely how big Los Angeles is. That is very lucky because we talk a lot about the traffic getting to that studio on this podcast. So you're very lucky.
Yeah, well, of course, you guys were sensible. You were living sort of in the Hollywood Hills and that sort of thing. So, you know, I can't stand being away from the beach. So We found Hermosa Beach and then moved to Manhattan. And Hermosa, I was watching a couple of the blogs where people were saying couldn't remember where you went on the bus that night. It was Hermosa Beach, Pier Avenue, the that you went through. I wasn't part of that gang. When we first discovered that we were popular, remember?
Oh, yeah. That was Hermosa?
Hermosa.
And we kept saying Redondo?
Yeah.
Or Manhattan. Okay. We were all over the place.
Yeah, but it was. And I remember, you know, the work the next day, everyone was just flabbergasted how many people turned up.
Yeah, that was definitely our aha moment, as we've been saying. It was pretty unbelievable and also very cool at the same time at Hermosa Beach. Thank you for giving us that answer.
You bring up a good point that you were a part of our show from the very beginning. You were there as everyone was experiencing this very, you know, huge show, getting a lot of attention. And I'm really interested to hear your side of your perception of, you know, what was going on, you know, the kids experiencing all of this fame and what your perception of all that was.
Yeah, well, because I'd been through Neighbours, which you mentioned earlier on, in Australia, where, you know, I was there for 8.5 years. That's a mistake. I had seen a lot of young people come along, have some success, be treated like superstars, because we always are on these sets and things. People look after us and, you know, stroke our egos and everything. And, you know, I've seen a lot of young people do that, and then they are written out of the series, and suddenly they're not treated like that again. So they desperately get out to the set again to see their old friends, and nobody sort of takes much notice because they're busy trying to look after the next new batch of people that have come through. So I was a little concerned, because having seen all of that, and I never forget sitting talking to Ben one night and saying, giving him a bit of a lecture about making sure he didn't get too big for his boots. We were sitting on a private jet flying to Las Vegas, if you'll recall. And I was saying, now don't get carried away with this. But hey, everyone seems to have stayed pretty stable and done well.
Yeah, for sure. I think. Yes, no.
Well, you have.
Oh, well, thanks. All we can say is what about ourselves, I guess.
Yeah.
So,
it was such fun.
Yeah. So how did the OC come about for you?
Well, I could tell you the long story, but I won't. I'll tell you a short story. I was at the Comic Con in San Diego because of my character in Star Trek Nemesis, who made a speech in a Senate. And while he was making the speech, a green light came out of a box and filled the Senate with this light, and then everything turned to stone, and I fell over and shattered on the floor, and then the opening credits started. So that's how big my part was. And they invited me down to Comic-Con to sign autographs, and I sat there all day, and not many people came and asked for autographs. But then my phone rang about 6 o'clock at night, and my manager saying that I'd been asked if I would come in and do just one scene in this new series that they were doing called The OC. So that's how it started. So on Monday, that was Friday night, Monday morning, I was there with you guys and, did, you know, expecting to do a scene. And they painted me bright orange, which I can sort of see why now.
We were just saying this in the last episode. I ended up with orange hair, an orange shirt, and orange skin. And it was just a lot of very tragic choices, I think.
Well, it is Orange County, everybody.
Thank you.
Yeah, right. But when you started the OC, you, like you said, you'd already had many, many years of work in Australia. And what made you decide to come over and come to the U.S.? After you'd had so much success in Australia.
Yeah, well, I was about your age, actually, when I came. So it was just, the show Neighbours was huge all over the world. It competed through the 80s to be number one in the world with Dallas and I think probably Dynasty. So I was really recognisable in Australia and in Britain. And that wasn't good, you know, so I wasn't getting a lot of other work. So I was doing voiceovers and things to make a living. And I did one of the runaway production shows called First Daughter, where we used the Sydney Town Hall as the White House. And we had it was a silly thing for ABC, I think it was. And I just thought, look, why don't I go to America and do a proper American show where I get paid American money instead of Australian money. So we just decided to come and have a look, and we did, and then liked it. We liked Hollywood. It's funny because everyone had bagged LA all of my life, everywhere all over the world. They hated it, you know, and things, but we loved it, and we still do, you know. It's a great city. And so we thought, why not? So we just came. That's all.
You make a good point. You've mentioned so many different places that you've either had to move for work, or usually we move for work. And do you ever get tired of being a gypsy?
I think that's for all of us. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I was talking to Trace about it earlier, you know, that we're all, you know, we ships passing in the night, you know, we don't get to know each other that well. You know, we work together all week, so you don't really want to spend the weekend together. So then the show's over and you go. And, you know, so it's only just a few people, like obviously YouTube, you know, who keep in touch. But that sort of happens a lot. It's just the nature of the job. Mm-hmm. And if you love it, you know, if you love doing it, I used to do it for nothing, you know. I was an amateur actor for years before I, you know, started getting paid. And so I don't have any desire to retire or stop doing it. So that means we're going to have to be nomadic. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, it is interesting how, well, you know, in certain cases you do become family with the people you work with, but then it's like the show ends and you might never speak to them again.
Yeah. And I, no offense meant at all. It's just, you know, you're moving and you start a new show with a whole new group of people to get to know and things. And, you know, it's, yeah, I wouldn't have guessed that that's the way it was, but you're right. It's,
yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting process. You came to the States, you know, and what I want to know is, how did you perfect your American accent so well?
Oh, thank you. The fact is, when I listened to, because I've been watching a bit of it now because I was coming on the show, so I better have a look, because I hadn't looked at it since I was in it, you know, I mean, years and years. And I can hear the New Zealand accent coming out all the time.
So, oh, really?
You know, I don't think it's that good, but it's all right, you know, and people, you know, they put up with it. Plus, I've actually just been a Kiwi butler in Dynasty, so I haven't had to do an American accent for a while.
Well, you bring up something that was catching up on your resume, Alan. You've never, ever, ever stopped working. And then I noticed at some points you were doing more than one show, even during the OC. So you either are the best agent in town, or you just never say no, or you just somehow worked it out. Were you tired? How did you do that? How do you keep that drive? And how did that work out? Because, yeah, it's impressive.
Well, if you're not going forward, you're not going backwards. So you end up going backwards. So I tend to do that. I tend to say yes to everything, mm-hmm. you know, because in Australia, you know, there wasn't a lot of everything to say no to. You know, you if you got a part, you were lucky. That was it. And I actually, until I got to America and looked back, I didn't realize quite how small the industry was that I had had, you know, a good run in. And so I tended to do that. Plus, I was really lucky because I was offered, you know, shows like Entourage and Lost and 24 and things like that when I was doing other things, and they're pretty good shows. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to say no to.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So when you were on the OC, do you remember what it was like? Do you have any, like, you know, memories or anecdotes of what it was like working with certain people on the show, other than telling Ben not to, you know?
We try to be honest and very transparent here. Yes, like, were we? Was I that. A diva who was silly? Because everyone,
I do think it was a bit hard for you because you were very young, and suddenly you had this old dude. You had to sort of be, you know. I mean, hell, the guy you were making love to when I turned up, he was, what was he, 15?
No, I don't think that's ever I always loved working with you. And in fact, it's always so rewarding. I always come with an attitude of, I want to work with good actors that elevate my performance. Working with you and working with Peter, there were some, you know, sometimes working with kids, not you, Rachel, but working with some people. But no, there are times when it's like, okay, I got to adjust you, move, you're in my light, or you're not hitting your mark or something. But there's just, from a very young age, I was very aware of taking what I can learn from people who are proficient at their craft. And we always had, I thought we always had some great scenes. Now, off camera, I don't think people ever, we get to see you once in this episode smile and they make a joke about it, but you were always giggling and telling jokes and we had a lot of fun. Those are my memories off set or in between takes.
It was. Yeah. Caleb was probably my favorite character I ever played, apart from King Arthur and Spamalot.
I want to hear about that too.
But Caleb was such fun because he was just, he was just naughty. Yeah, he was just a naughty boy, really. And if he could be nasty, he would. And, he just thoroughly enjoyed himself all the time. And I really enjoyed playing him, I have to admit. I was sad when that sort of came to an end.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.
But then I was lucky because almost immediately I got, what was it?
Ugly Betty. Yeah.
And then that ended, and then I got this invitation to go to London for 6 months to do Spamalot, which was,
I'm such a Monty Python fan, and I've seen the production, I had no idea that you got to play Arthur in Spamalot in the West End. To me, that must be the most rewarding thing, singing, dancing on stage, instant gratification. There's like, you couldn't give more of yourself, right?
No, and the other thing about that show, it ends with a huge wedding, and they drop, large, this size, confetti on everybody in the audience. And the people are roaring, and then it's time for them to give me a standing ovation. And they did every night because they were standing because they were having such fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it was interesting because I finished doing Ugly Betty, went out to Australia to do a series called Sea Patrol for a few months. And while I was there, I got the call from London asking if I'd go and do Spamalot. And that was a new production just started in Melbourne in Australia. So we went to see it. And I remember talking to Trace, leaning across to Trace about 20 minutes in. I said, the trouble with shows like this is you laugh so much at the beginning, you sort of run out towards the end. But that didn't happen. I just about lost a lung that night. I just had such fun. I've given Trace the instructions that I don't care who's doing it, if the local school are doing it. If there's a Spamalot performance, I want to go and see it. I did that 120 times or something. It was just marvelous fun every night.
I'm tickled because I did a lot of musical theater when I was a teenager, and I just never had more fun. And I wish I'd been able to do it more. I just didn't think I was I don't think my singing talent was up to snuff.
You were a soprano.
Well, I trained some. I did Maria and West Side Story and that kind of stuff. But
you did? Yeah. That's a big deal. Would you just throw that in there? Like,
por favor, Anita, make the neck lower.
Yes, of course.
I think they've just remade that, didn't they?
Oh my gosh, it's coming out. Spielberg. Yeah, I'm all excited about that.
Right.
Yeah,
that's going to be very exciting. Yeah. A bunch of musical theater nerds here. Today we're discussing a very important episode, The Proposal, which you're a very pivotal part of this episode, Alan.
Yes. I watched it just the other day.
Yeah.
He wasn't very nice, though, was he, to Misha? It wasn't nice.
Well, we'll get into that. But what? I'm just going to give our listeners a little synopsis on what we're dealing with today. The Balboa Lighthouse is almost open, but a major roadblock, the loss of their liquor license, stands to ruin it all. Luke is leaving Newport, but first wants forgiveness from Marissa. When neither she nor Julie will talk to him, he drinks too much and nearly dies. Caleb proposes to Julie to make her happy, strikes a deal with Marissa. Strikes a deal. Mm-hmm. Seth and Summer undergo a massive home repair project to make Marissa feel more at home at Jimmy's. Directed by Helen Shaver, written by Liz Friedman and Josh Schwartz. Episode 24, The Proposal.
I think this, I actually saw this episode described as the episode that destroyed everything. and I thought, I wonder what this is about exactly. So I just think it's an interesting, this marriage and this union of these two people and being completely oblivious and not caring, and the ripple effect of their actions on all of these characters is, it's pretty epic in this one, don't you think?
I love the way that your character just, if when Caleb asks you to get married, you just say, sure. Yeah.
No, I know.
Yeah, you're
I
like,
know.
Kiki. Yeah.
Kiki. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Very fun episode for both of you, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, the episode opens with Seth, Summer, Marissa, and Ryan at the movies. Which really was really cute because, you know, the movie ends, Marissa's bawling her eyes out. So is Seth. Which was like really cute. And then, you know, the credits on the screen were showing names of our crew, right? I feel like I saw Jamie Barber.
Right. Because everybody wanted to know, like, what's this Autumn Leaves is Playing, which is one of my favorite old songs. And everyone wanted to, I was like, what is the movie? And it turns out that it's a shout out to our crew members. Just the credits.
I was trying to figure out the movie as I'm rewatching it. Yeah. And I see Jamie Barber's name. I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't notice that. Gosh, I'll go back and have another look.
That's also a beautiful old theater called the Warner Grand in San Pedro. Do you remember shooting there, Rachel?
I do. I actually remember it vividly, shooting there in San Pedro. And I remember the across the street, you know, the kids go to Jamba Juice after. And I remember it was directly across the street from where we were filming. And it was like this promenade of shops and stuff. Mm-hmm. Down in San Pedro. And I remember at the time there was like a dog adoption going on or something, like a dog fair. And I almost like went home with three dogs. That's my memory of shooting down in San Pedro. But there's also some really, you know, the scenes that are going on in this location when the kids leave the movie theater and everyone's being so protective of Marissa. They're like worried, you know, any little thing is going to set her off because who knows with this one. And you see Luke sitting there. And Julie is approaching to meet him in the cutest bucket hat, by the way. And bucket hats are back in fashion once again. So good for you.
I love that she's being incognito with a hat, but she's got her low cut shirt like down to her belly button. Like, she's still, but you know what? It's so, you know, I can't believe just how flat out mean Julie's being to Luke. And you know, not taking any responsibility, not like, honey, I'm sorry, but can we do it this way? It's just, I just blocked you from my buddy list. She's just venomous, like not taking responsibility at all. Very unlikable, to say the least.
Yeah, the maternal instincts, I would say, are not Julie's strong point.
No.
For sure. But, you know, the four of the kids, like, they, of course, walk there right as Julie is sitting there with Luke and Marissa sees them together. And here we go.
Yeah. Poor Marissa. I mean, really, it when everyone's walking on eggshells around her and poor Luke and I don't know what is it about these adults? Alan, we've been watching this show. You know, when I was shooting it, I was just reveling in how nasty she was. And now as we've gotten older and my daughter's 21 and I'm like, I can't believe, and we're shouting at the screen. And so I'm right there with the audience with that. But the next day when Seth walks in on Ryan, I don't know why this was such this funny, like questioning Seth's masculinity. And he makes it awkward that he sees Ryan taking off of his shirt, and he's like, do you work out? Not really. Cool, me neither. I'm gonna go watch some hockey. I mean, it's just this funny like through line that's like, I just feel like this is Josh's, or he has said that Seth is his voice to get through the show.
Right He's really emasculating Seth a lot in this episode. He's like, all right, I'll watch football. It's like, football's not for 4 months. All right, I'll watch hockey. Oh, it's over. It's like, he just can't get it right.
Well, it's also,
poor Seth.
Yeah, we're making a point of this being Luke's last episode you know, he's leaving.
Right.
And
yeah, he shows up to tell Seth and Ryan that he's moving to Portland.
Yeah.
No, it was a very nice performances by him.
I agree. Was really lovely, right?
Yeah, Chris Carmack really, really was amazing in this episode. He always is, but like he really gave it his
he
all.
Did. And yeah.
Yeah. I was very impressed. Absolutely.
Do you guys remember Helen Shaver? She's a
the director.
The director. I remember, yeah, she's gone on to direct so many things, and I remember, you know, we didn't get a lot of female directors. I think we had like three for the whole series. And
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So she's an actress, or she was, is still, and she's still directing big things. So I just remember being very welcoming to a female director. Little tidbit on the side.
For sure.
Probably wouldn't have affected me as much. But I knew what you mean. Yes. I don't remember, to be honest, but that's largely because I don't remember a lot of things.
Do you remember much about this episode? I mean, of course, we all have our different experiences and things that we, you know, sometimes we remember certain things or things are just jogged. Our memories are jogged watching this.
Yes.
But did you have
a lot of that?
Yeah.
Watching I hadn't watched it at all since we finished the show. In fact, two years ago, I was in a backyard party here in Atlanta, and who should walk through the door but Peter Gallagher.
Oh.
So, you know, that was the first time I'd had anything to do with anything, you know, OC-ish since I finished doing the show, you know. And so it was lovely to see him. He's a lovely fellow.
He's so young.
Yeah, really such a talent too. But again, see, that's the thing. People don't talk about it much, but it really is that what a talent, what a group of people to put together. It really worked, you know. Every scene, there was no, you didn't ever think the people weren't the characters, you know what I mean? It just was really beautifully done.
That's what we're discovering on this podcast, because we're interviewing, you know, Norman Buckley and Matt Ramsey, our editors, and Deborah Fisher, our writers, all of the people that made the show what it is, because when you think about it, it really is such a magical moment when a film gets made, a TV show gets made, and everything that goes into it so that the audience can actually hit play or just turn on the channel and watch it. It's really rewarding for us to get to understand all of those aspects and why this show was a success and why it really affected a lot of people and had that cultural phenomenon.
The editors, I've only ever in my life once done this. I watched an episode. I don't even remember which one it was. But I had quite a poignant scene in it. And I hadn't, being an actor in soaps, which is what I'd done, what Neighbours was, you know, they used to say, you know, don't pause, don't pause, don't pause. I'll change and watch the news on the other channel. Don't pause. No pauses, you know. So I don't do lots of dewy pauses in my acting. But in one scene I should have, and the editors took the wide shot, the medium, and the close-up and ran them all one after the other so that I left enough space, because I hadn't left enough space. And the scene was magic the way they did it. But that wasn't my doing, it was theirs, you know. So I remember running upstairs when at work the next day just to find them, just to say, wow, because I hadn't thought of taking the time, but they did, and they found footage, you know, to take the time, which was magic.
Yeah. I mean, editors are truly phenomenal. I've really learned, you know, you learn to appreciate so much because I didn't ever really know, you know, what they did and how much went into it. But learning it, you're like, oh, you're like the magicians behind the curtain that actually make it all work. And it's truly a craft and a gift. And I would love to just sit in on a editing session.
They do that thing of they're looking for the happy accidents that most art, great art, comes from, you know, and they find them and, you know, and pop them in the places that make it magic. But anyway, I just think there were a lot of fine actors as well that gave them the material on the OC. It was a cut above a soap, you know. I mean, it's described as a soap, but it really was a cut above that.
And we were just learning. Even Josh has said, you know, he was just, they were doing, Josh and Stephanie have said, they were doing what they like, whether it was the music or the meta humor.
I think on one of the other episodes of your show I watched, they talked about the music being another character. I agree. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was astounding, the music at the time. I mean, a lot of shows do that now, so it doesn't stand out as much. But at the time, it was really, the music was fabulous.
And in this episode in particular, the music is my weak point, so I'm trying to educate myself. But in this episode, I definitely noticed, and we'll talk about that when we get to those scenes. But I do want to say that when we go into the Cohen kitchen and Sandy gets this letter, well, first of all, sorry, the Jimmy and Sandy handshake, and it's kind of adorable, dorky, white boy handshake. I just saw, because Peter and Tate giggled so much on that set. I mean, it was just a laugh a minute in between takes. Do you remember when we'd have those big scenes, Alan, in the kitchen? Yeah. And half the time in between takes, it was just like stand-up comedy, right?
It was mayhem. Yeah, it was just fun. It was a time. It was a wonderful time, I have to admit. With crazy things like flying to Las Vegas in a private jet. I mean, my goodness. How bizarre was that?
What were you flying for? Do you remember?
It was a...
like a Billboard chart award, something.
No, we were going there to shoot scenes.
Well, I think the episode, the strip coming up.
Yeah, that'll be that.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's coming up. Yeah, we have a guest for that one.
Oh. Mm-hmm. That's like two away, I think.
Yeah, that's Caleb's bachelor party. Forcing, yes, and this is one of those things, like, there was a, especially in the beginning, there was a lot of things that Caleb was doing behind the scenes that the audience wasn't aware of. He was probably the most enigmatic character of all. You know, we know that Julie's a...
On Valentine's Day 1929, a group of gangsters was massacred in a cold Chicago garage. The crime shook the country. And even though investigators had only just started looking for answers, everyone was sure they already knew who was behind the crime. Al Capone. Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of the new true crime history podcast, American Criminal. We take you inside the minds of some of our most notorious felons and outlaws, exploring the dark side to the American dream. In our latest season, a child of Italian immigrants sets out to make good on the promises of that dream. But Al Capone's path to success doesn't take him down the straight and narrow. Instead, he transforms himself from a smarter-than-your-average thug into the most infamous criminal America has ever known. Listen to American Criminal Al Capone wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get early ad-free access to the entire season first, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe at intohistory.com.
Gold digger. We know she's a narcissist. We know that she's sleeping around, but Caleb's just really mysterious. There's a lot of shit going on behind the scenes with this guy.
Yeah.
I mean, in the storyline in this where, you know, so their liquor license gets revoked at the restaurant with Sandy. And I actually I know that I'm jumping forward a bit, but I like that Sandy goes to Caleb for help. And that has never happened before, I don't think.
And it wasn't voluntary. I mean, he didn't want to.
Right. Oh, yeah. He's kicking and screaming, but yes. I just, you know.
Yeah.
Right. And when he says, like, I did a favor for you, and Caleb goes, no, I'm holding it over your head. I want you to, you know. He does it.
Of course.
But he's totally honest. And to that point.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast FREE.
Point. Sandy and Caleb, I really love your scenes together. It gives so much texture and so much drama. And I too was disappointed when Caleb, I'm sorry guys, spoiler alert, our podcast, we talk about things all over because I know some people get upset, but I too thought it was not a good choice that Caleb wasn't with us anymore, but.
Well, it's all right. It's okay. Cause it's, I mean, we're the same creator. I've just had to have him do the same thing to me just now.
Oh, wait. Okay. So can I ask you this? Because I did see this. How many characters of yours have had fatal heart attacks?
Many. Many. And it depends entirely. Many. In fact, they were going to do that on Dynasty, but I did say to them, you know, if you do that, you do realize that I'll have to actually carry the book of Guinness Book of Records in my hand when I'm dying, because I think I would have to be the person that's had the most heart attacks on TV. I must be. So it took me, I had to go back to them three times before they would agree to kill me some other way.
So are you officially, may I ask, are you officially dead on Dynasty, or are you coming?
I am. Yes, I've been dead for some months.
Okay.
You look great.
I keep coming back as a ghost.
But you're so your character, but will you continue to work on the show as, oh, you're coming back as a ghost? Or are you done with the show?
I've done now. Okay. I spent the last 6 months being a ghost.
Okay. Okay.
Being very wise.
Okay. Mm. Because I noticed that there was like a Reddit discussion about you leaving. Just so you know.
Yeah, what was that? Oh, well.
No, well, just like, because that. I, you know, I'm catching up on what you've been doing so I can,
right,
so I can be in the know and the fans want to know, like, what's going on?
I looked at what you guys have been doing, and you and I were in Entourage at the same time.
Right. We had Doug Ellen on an episode. He was a huge fan of the OC. So he came on for one of our episodes and talked about Oliver and our disdain for Oliver. But yes.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. I know. There's quite a few people from the OC on Entourage. And you got to do the film as well, right?
I did, yes.
I didn't get that.
Didn't you? Oh.
That's okay.
I had to walk through Warner Brothers lot, the whole lot, walking purposefully. And then they kept cutting away, you see, and cutting back, and you were still walking.
You were the head of Warner Brothers. You were the Peter Roth of Warner Brothers, our boss. For all of these shows.
I could never have done it, really. But yeah, I love to play those characters, like doctors and lawyers, all the intelligent people. I play those people.
I play them well.
Thank you.
So, guys, you know, we're not talking about something very important in this episode.
Right. Yes.
Right.
Summer has the idea to remodel Marissa's room.
This is important.
This is very important.
It's so adorable.
Very important stuff. No, I actually really liked this storyline in the show where Summer recruits Seth to help her redo the room. By the way, what they accomplish in like, I don't know, a day and a half?
Miracle. It's a miracle.
I mean, it's a TV magic, I tell you. But I was very impressed. And it's funny because there's when they're in there and they have the tools, and again, it's showing Seth that he doesn't know what he's doing, and he's like, I can just pay people to do this. That reminds me of Josh Schwartz. Just pay people to do it. I'm not doing it myself. There's like, I'm holding up these tools as we're working, and over the years, I have seen this pop up as a GIF, a GIF. How the hell do you pronounce that?
Is it a GIF, you
know,
guys?
And then, you know, it's pretty funny. Like
it's a famous one. I've seen it. Yeah.
Yeah. In this scene, I was like, oh, that's what this is from. But, it's so playful and it's really sweet. And I liked that storyline. And also Marissa and Ryan rekindling is happening. They have their first kiss that they've had in a while. That happens at the top of the episode on the pier. And I had all the feels.
Right, and that's where Pride by Syntax was playing. And as they were kissing, and he said, we haven't done this in a while, I was like, you're right, they haven't done this in a while. And of course, we have to do the shout out to the Newport Balboa Bar, those famous ice cream bars that she's...
I thought it was a Balboa Bar, the ice cream. That was miraculously not melting, and she wasn't eating it and just holding it.
Yeah, I noticed that. That was a miracle.
Was another TV miracle.
But I am noticing, you know, how the fans were always like, oh, Ryan and Marissa, they're apart and they're getting back together. And I was like, well, so in the last one, when he rescues her from, you know, out in Chino, and I was like, when did they officially just get back together? You know, it was, you know, it wasn't like, hey, are we doing this? They just did. They just got back together. There was no discussion, which is kind of, I guess.
They must have discussed it off screen.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that goes on off screen. But Rachel, this scene where you're saying you don't like hardware stores, you cry during chick flicks, next thing you're going to tell me, you walk in on Ryan changing. Ha ha. But this, Alan, do you remember Rachel and Adam used to kind of talk like that? Their banter reminds me of them in real life.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes. It was seamless.
Did we?
Yes.
I mean, talking shit is definitely my specialty, but...
good
That's
fun.
Funny. Yeah, Adam, I can see, like, we're having a lot of fun in these scenes.
I think that also has an effect on a show, doesn't it? I have worked on shows where people don't get sort of close, but, you know, really everyone, from whether it be in the makeup trailer all the way through to... you know, on the set, everything, really. Everyone was just having a good time. Mm-hmm. You know, we had our moments. There were issues, but...
What issues, Alan?
Do tell. Rachel told...
Have any issues to share?
Rachel told Tate that she was sorry for being a little asshole, which I don't... I was like, I don't...
Were you a little asshole specifically to him, or do you mean just generally?
Yeah, just Tate, because he deserved it. No, I'm just kidding. No, there was just rumors, you know, that Tate had said the kids were kind of, you know, assholes, essentially. And I was like, well, if I ever was a little asshole, I'm sorry.
Oh, wow. He didn't ever say that to me. Yeah. But I remember because he and I ended up, you know, like nothing that we did, but we ended up replacing each other. Like, so he was written out when I was written in, and then I was written out and he was written back in. But along the way, he became a director, and now he directs all sorts of wonderful things.
Yes.
Yes.
So it wasn't a bad thing for him. I didn't think of it.
I said, what was it like when they told you, you know, that you weren't coming back? And he said he was devastated. And I think that's when these things happen, when your characters get killed off or they don't continue writing, it's really hard not to take things personally, you know?
Right.
It really is.
King of heart attacks over there. How do
I know?
I was going to say, you have to actually get used to it eventually, you know. Mm-hmm. You just have to cop it. And then, you know, if somebody else hires you, you think, well, it can't have been because I wasn't good enough. Mm-hmm. You know,
right.
Because we're always expecting someone to come along and tap us on the shoulder and say, okay, fun's over, joke's over, you've had your fun, off you go.
Right.
You
know,
So are you going to tell us about the issues you were referring to? Or are we just glazing over that?
We're glazing over.
Spill the tea. How bitchy was I?
Never. Yeah. Enough about me. What do you think of me? Not saying anything more.
Okay, well, back to the episode.
Yeah, okay. Let's back to the episode. Let's talk about you showing up to Marissa to ask for Julie's hand in marriage. This was a very bold move on Caleb's part and honestly a bit shocking.
It was a bit shocking, and I didn't really understand quite why until
I think it's just
later.
To move the story along. I don't know.
Yeah, it was a sort of charming thing to do in a sort of gross way. He wasn't
very un-Caleb like,
sort of, but then behind it.
Yeah. I'm still wondering why Caleb is asking Julie, like, what are his motivations? He says, I love your mother and family is very important to me. And is he just, you know, needs instant gratification or just sees something he wants? Because we know that he really doesn't probably love Julie. I'm just curious.
Oh, no, I think he...
You do? Did you play it, Love for Love?
Look in the mirror, love. You know, he
or is it,
was very
it was the sex.
Girl, right?
It was the sex.
But it's, yeah, sex. Okay. Know, absolutely. I thought that. That's how I played it anyway. That she's a real trophy. And, you know, he's the sort of character that likes trophies, you know.
Yeah, we found that out because he likes booty calls. Yeah, booty
call. That wasn't booty call.
That
was a fun day for me. You know, you know that I haven't got a lot of hair. I had a little bit more back then, and I but at the time I used to trim my hair with one of those big razor things with a spacer on, and you just go zh, 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 and things. And I had one of those, and we were doing the booty call. And I thought, I better just trim my hair up. So I trimmed my hair up. And then there was I'd taken the spacer thing off, and I was just doing my eyebrows and just, you know, things. And I saw a little bit of hair up here that was wrong. And I had hair right across here. So I went zhoop, like that with it, and thought, holy shit, I just shaved the top of my head. And I did. And I had to do the booty call scene that day. And I called my manager and said, fuck, what do I do? I've just shaved the top of my head. And he said, have you told anyone? I said, no. He said, well, say nothing. Say nothing. And who knows what will happen. Well, the first time, and I actually saw a scene the other day that I was watching, so it wasn't the first time it was done, but the first time I had been shot from above, when I came to the door, they shot it from right above, right down onto the two of us as you opened the door. And I'd shaved the top of my head, but no one noticed and no one said anything. And oh, so we just carried on. And, I thought, that was a terrible fright. That was the booty call day for me was the day I shaved the top of my head.
What you don't know is we all knew and we've been talking about it ever since. No, but I still love that when I said, is this a booty call? And you said, what's a booty call? And you still say it with the booty. So it's actually,
sorry,
was no, that's what made it so organically wonderful. Because I didn't actually know that term at the time. And I don't think either one of us remember.
Did, no.
Yeah. I didn't know what it was, it was a real genuine moment.
You said
moment.
It very well with your usual.
You acted like you were very familiar with them.
Yes, indeed.
I got familiar.
Well done. Got familiar real quick.
Yeah, right.
I want to get to the proposal. I'm sorry, but I just need to get there.
We
can cover the other stuff because there's a lot to cover. But
whose idea was it that I'd drop on my knee? Was that mine?
You would know.
Yeah,
no clue. I want to know whose idea was it that it was an emerald?
Yeah. What about a diamond?
I'm not really sure who came up with it, but there was a discussion because I have green eyes. I have a feeling it may have been just like an aesthetic thing, but that's a question for, it could have been a costume thing. I do remember us having a discussion about it, but I don't know. I mean, emeralds are beautiful. I think somebody came to me and said, what do you think about an emerald? And I think I was like, that's great. That's a great idea. What do you think about it? What
I
do
like
you think?
Unexpected.
But it had to be a 20 carat.
Right. It was very large. It was rather large.
Yes.
So when the lighthouse opens, though, I thought it was a really, first of all, this is, again, the music. The Loose Caboose by Henry Mancini is from the party scene in Breakfast at Tiffany's.
I didn't know that.
Because I was like, this is like the best music. What is this music? And it just gives it that kind of, you know, in Breakfast at Tiffany's, everybody's laughing and, that jovial. And the music gave it that kind of like, it's a party and it's going to get wacky feeling. And because Breakfast at Tiffany's was kind of a, you know, I don't know if the word is wacky, eccentric, I guess could be the term.
Yeah, that's really cool. And the whole opening of this, you know, first we open on Marissa. I remember that Chanel, she's wearing a Chanel dress that.
With martini glasses on it.
Yeah, it was so cool. Oh, God, I hope I'm right. I'm pretty sure it was a Chanel dress.
Right.
And Seth and Summer are still on their mission. Summer's doing the hand signals. And I can see I can see myself. I remember that it was impossible for me not to laugh while doing it. And you can, like, see that I'm, like, ready to break because it was so ridiculous and I wanted to make it as big and ridiculous as possible. And I think I succeeded. It was pretty, pretty insane. But I do remember that vividly. We're out of there, and then a lot else unfolds.
Seth and Summer were just in rare form. I mean, every time, this is when you guys were in your groove, and every time you guys in this storyline, you know, and back when he even said, you know, you said, was I mean to you? And that really sweet moment, and, you know, looking through the yearbook, or just your banter and this development of your storyline. It's just, you guys are, I smile every time I watch you guys on camera during
this. Yeah, I felt the same way. I'm with this episode especially, I felt that way a lot. But sometimes the two of you would start to giggle in a scene, and I would look and think, no, they're really, that's real. They're having far too much fun there. That's not the characters. That's them having fun.
Right. They did have fun.
Right.
For sure.
But yes, when you do propose, yes.
Yep.
Going down.
Yep. I love that you, I said this earlier, that you're like, Kiki, like you like show it.
But when he proposes, yeah, when he proposes and he goes, will you marry me? Oh my gosh. And of course, Luke sees it. And here's where the great editing comes in, where you just show every single face. And it's Haley, Jimmy, Kirsten, Sandy going, holy fuck.
What?
Tate's reaction, Jimmy's reaction is my favorite. I actually laughed out loud. He was like, yeah, you should have a drink. And he's like, you know, I should have a drink. Like his whole exchange with Sandy and Kirsten is this is unraveling. And I thought just, I was really, Tate made me laugh in that.
And I loved Kelly in this. She goes off the deep end with this, you know, monologue of how awful it is. And it's worse and worse and worse. And, you know, I'm like, God, is she being overdramatic? And can't she just be happy for the gruesome twosome? I mean, I just love that she gets to do this. And she's like, the marriage is an asteroid that's hit the earth. And now we just have to wait and see what species survives. And she starts drinking her ass off. And Ken Sandy's like, yes. Oh, geez, here we go.
Yep, here we go. Julie Cooper is her stepmom.
Yeah, so I, and one thing I would say about the show, I felt it could have gone for a lot more years because, you know, what you're talking about, they're wonderful, wonderful moments that, you know, a lot of shows don't capture that stuff. It's just, it was something about it. I just thought it was really marvelous. Yeah, just me. I'm biased.
Well, but you come from so many different, you come from doing traditional, I guess, dramas and doing all kinds of different genres. And I guess that's one of the things that I keep, you know, I repeat myself, but that it's not an original. I guess Josh has said he didn't watch teen soaps. He watched Freaks and Geeks and So-Called Life. And that's kind of what he based this on, and which definitely gave it a different formula, right? It was a different, it was a freer form and, you know, just original or, you know. Yeah.
Well, it was, I mean, I came in to do a scene and, you know, it ended up being 2 years and it was always a surprise to me. That was the thing about the show. Mm-hmm. Just, it was always, you know, it could so easily have just been another soap, you know, but it just rose, just something about it. And you laughed out loud a lot, which is because it wasn't supposed to be a comedy, but it really was funny, especially Rach with you and Adam. Goodness me.
Yeah. Yes, a lot of laughter. The opposite of laughter is what happens with Luke in this episode when he's drinking. As we said, he was very impressive. His acting was on point. Poor Luke. And, you know, he crashes his car, winds up in the hospital. Marissa is finally ready to see him as she learns he's leaving forever. And the scene in the hospital bed where Marissa and Ryan both say bye to Luke. I cried. Mindy, yes, you can attest that I always cry, but
I cried in this one.
It was too. You did?
Yes, because I don't always cry, but I did. I can be cynical, but this one, just because I think, first of all, Luke, he's trying to tell people he loves Julie, which is like kind of out of the, you know, like I was like, has this ever happened to any of you guys? Or it's like, oh, he's using the love word where I guess it was just sex for Julie. But I just feel for him as if loving Julie is going to make the situation better. Please understand. It's not just sex. I love her. But
right.
But I do. I think there's something about it because I know Chris as a human being. And I think he was disappointed as well to be written out of the show, but I've also found out that this character was one of the most difficult ones for Josh to write. And when we talk about showrunners having, you know, there's a lot of responsibility and seeing a through line with the character or, you know, saying, okay, I don't know what to do for this character anymore. Or, I mean, I don't know exactly the details, but he has said that it was one of the more difficult characters for him to write. And like, what more can I do?
Because he was the water polo player, the very opposite
exactly.
of what he was. Yeah.
Yeah. Because,
both my boys, in fact, all my children and my wife and I all played water polo. So,
did you? Know,
I have a lot of sympathy for water polo players. Yes.
But no, it represented the USC water polo playing guys that he would see at the parties and get all
Josh
the girls. Yeah. And
couldn't relate to.
Right. But he had said that it was one of the more difficult, but he's also said that in hindsight, he would have loved to have kept Luke and Anna and Jimmy around. But when you realize there's so many, you know, it was his first show. So
yeah, now he lives in Santa Barbara.
Partly,
yes.
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 My favorite line of this episode happens in the hospital scene when Luke says, "Welcome to Portland, bitch." It's a little ode to our podcast.
Yes.
As this episode concludes, there's the scene where you straight up blackmail Marissa.
Yeah, yeah. I watched that just last night, that scene. What an asshole.
It's pretty like, you know, Marissa goes in being like, I can finally do something to get my mother back, you know, and she walks in and you're like, I already know everything. But I was questioning, do you think or do you know, did Caleb know about Julian Luke?
This gets revealed later on.
Okay.
But what did you think? I mean, she takes it at face value. She goes, oh, okay. She doesn't.
Yeah, she's like, oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah, well, I guess it's you'd expect that Caleb would be an asshole like that. And he did it well. I was happy with what I did because he was really awful.
Well, and I had to look up and I was like, this is more like extortion than blackmail. She goes, oh, you're going to blackmail me. And of course, I had to look up the definition. It's like blackmail means that you're going to release information that's embarrassing. Extortion is do this or I'm threatening you. So I'm threatening your dad. Mm. By extorting, you know, do this. So I don't know.
Well, you did look it up.
Semantics.
But very good.
Yes, there's going to be, I think it was a deliberate choice by the writers that Caleb says, oh, I know everything. And for some reason, I think it's a deliberate choice. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so too. It's interesting because there have been similarities between Dynasty and the OC. My character in Dynasty walks up to the lady of the house and says, I know everything. So I don't know if that's a throwback to Caleb from the OC or not, but, you know, I know everything.
You do. So the end of the episode, you know, Ryan takes Marissa back to Jimmy's. And then they're here, Seth and Summer upstairs, and they go up, and obviously it's the reveal of the room that they've been working on, and they transform for her. And it's really sweet, this scene, I thought. And, you know, Marissa's genuinely touched.
Yeah, she did a really lovely job.
I thought Misha was really lovely all the way through. It must have been very hard for her working with all these old people. Because, I mean, even the kids were old to her.
That's true.
Fair.
It is very fair.
She was young.
And so,
yeah, there was a lot. She carried a lot.
She did. And I've watched, you know, always watched it closely. And she's a really very fine actor. I don't know whether she's carried on working or what's happened, but she did great work then for a 16-year-old or whatever it was.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
When she opens the door and sees this room, and it really is beautiful, and the wall is the same image as the movie. And I also wanted to point out, is this the first time, because we see Seth actually paint the blue, and of course, later on, we know that he's an artist with his comics, and he painted that, but I feel like that's the first time we reveal that Seth is an artist.
Does it become a thing? Is it talked about later?
He draws graphic novel characters.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So I thought that was, artist.
And, good point.
Yeah, but I thought that was really lovely. But by accepting...
Shout out to our set painters, by the way.
Right, yes.
For that mural.
But when she accepts Caleb's proposal, essentially she'll now be this, which is bittersweet. She'll be the princess locked in the tower with the evil king and queen. And she's, and it's bittersweet because she has this lovely room that, that was given to her by her family, her friends. And now she, although she can visit it, but I think that's pointed it's out.
Probably
that she,
for sure.
Because as we
where
know,
she would rather be.
She's going to have to go. She and really is the princess locked in the tower in the next season.
For sure. And Summer finds her Care Bear, which I love all the ode to, you know, My Little Pony, Care Bears, like all of the things that I grew up with as a kid, that Josh obviously grew up with as a kid, play a very important role in the series. But yeah, and the last shot of Seth, Summer, Ryan, and Marissa on the bed, that's also something I've seen over the years a lot. There's like a still of the four of us on the bed, and it's just like a really sweet, they are all happy, you know, and together. And it was a really nice moment at the end of this episode. So well done, you two, on the proposal. You both were fantastic.
Thanks, Ryan.
Oh, you know what? Yes. There was one scene, guys, that I really wanted to make a mention of. When Julie is just rattled, just, she's such a narcissist. I'm so glad that her arc changes, but she's so involved in the wedding and just completely oblivious and doesn't know about Luke. And when Seth comes in and she's must have been like, what a nasty woman. Must have been that divorce he's going through. And Seth goes, yeah, that's right. And I actually saw, at first it was like, is she like, don't you say anything? But I actually saw some guilt in there. Yeah. Some uncomfortableness.
Oh, yeah, you were like, oh, shit. I saw that in your face, definitely.
There were layers in the acting. Mm-hmm. All layers.
For sure.
Layers of acting going on.
There was just amazing.
Like I said, fantastic job this episode.
Yes,
truly. Alan, we have some voicemails for you, if you don't mind staying around to answer a few fan questions.
Sure.
Great.
We had a lot for you.
The voicemails. We did. We had like an overwhelming response to you.
Oh, that's nice. Wow.
Yes.
Hi, Mindy and Rachel. This is Bree from Perth, Australia. My question's for Alan Dale. Alan is a New Zealand-born Kiwi. I was wanting to know how you find putting on an American accent for your shows. Is there a particular American that you emulate when you are doing your scenes? And also, what's with your character always having heart attacks, which I notice is how they killed off your character in Neighbours, Ugly Betty, and then again in the OC?
Yes, the heart attacks. we've sort of discussed that, but the American accent. Well, I realise that, you know, what Americans. I have a little sort of thing. Like, for example, when I do a French accent, I have a little thing that I do. You go, do you find that when it rains, your bottom lip fills up with water? So that's how I get the French. So how I get the American one is I go, hern, 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 hern. And now I'm ready to talk with American accent.
Oh.
That's
good
of,
tricks.
Just.
Do you do all kinds of accents? Did you have to do something? Oh, South African. You've done South African. You've done.
That was the ER. Yeah, that's the first job I got when I first came. I got a 5-episode arc in ER playing a South African surfer with a very bad back. Who comes from Hawaii, and I go into the hospital and they paralyze me. So,
man, you've had it rough.
Oh, it's been a tough career.
Hi, my name's Leah, and I've been a longtime fan of the OC, and I've been rewatching it. But in high school, I used to watch it all the time. So, and now rewatching it, I just see Caleb's character being so serious all the time, which of course. That's just who he is in the OC, but still has a little bit of, you know, sense of humor. So I just wanted to see if Alan Dale remembers ever trying to be super serious in the OC, but then just breaking because it's just kind of funny because it's just sometimes the storylines like are just hilarious and he's like trying to be the serious one. So I'm just kind of wondering how he did it to stay in character and stay serious.
Well, it's interesting. I've never thought of him being so serious. I've thought of him having always a bit of a spark in his eye, because what mischief can he do now, sort of? But we, I mean, you guys know, we broke up many times. That's part of the fun of doing a show like this. And yeah, as I say, he was my favorite character, I think, I've ever played.
There was an episode, I think it was it in The Girlfriend, possibly right in the beginning, where you, I mean, when you make your debut, you're bigger than life, and this
orange,
just awful. Some of the comments are just scathing when it comes to, you make fun of your grandson and you make fun of Ryan. There's some that were, like, for me, it was, I would giggle because they were so harsh sometimes. But Caleb had some of those harsh lines too sometimes.
Oh, I love those.
Right.
So, probably I did have trouble keeping a straight face sometimes. I'm sorry if it showed through.
What was it like filming The OC compared to filming Lost? I loved you in both, but would just love your opinion. Thank you. Love you, Melinda and Rachel.
Aw.
Very sweet. Yeah, well, I think I told you earlier that, you know, my wife forgot to pick me up from work one day and I walked home. And that was from The OC. I couldn't do that from Lost because it was made in Hawaii. So the downside of that, I had to go to Hawaii all the time, about 20 trips to Hawaii. So no, it was lovely doing Lost. I enjoyed it. It was an interesting thing when I was doing Spamalot in London. They wanted to shoot some scenes and they wanted me to fly out to Hawaii, which is a long way from London. Mm. And it would have meant taking a week off the show. So I said no. So they brought a crew to London. We shot scenes for Lost in London while I was doing Spamalot. So all of a sudden, what was the name of the character? Yeah, he ended up with a beard suddenly, because I had a beard as King Arthur. And so suddenly I woke up one morning with a beard. Yeah. I don't know why. So yeah, that was fun.
How cool.
You're such an inspiration doing, I mean, I've had a few times during The OC, I popped off for a guest star here and there, but you've done it quite a bit. So if you can do it, we can do it.
Well, it's a let you, I wasn't allowed to do those things while we were shooting Dynasty. So I had to concentrate on being a butler.
Right. Well, and also Liz Gillies, we just had her on. What a delight. And she got to direct.
Yes.
An episode. How's, I mean, we didn't get to actually mention that, but what a lovely lady.
Oh, she's
loved
just,
her.
Oh God. Yeah. Talent. Oh Lord. There's right. I mean, you walk in the room in like those sumptuous sets we have with the grand piano and things. And suddenly, you know, you hear the piano playing, turn around, there she is. And then, you know, it came up that I'd done Spamalot and she started singing all the songs from Spamalot. She knows. She is just such a huge talent. That's all I can say. Just amazing young woman. Mm.
Did you get to sing on Dynasty too?
You know, I didn't. And they did have a couple of episodes, but they didn't ask me to. I'm not sure why. But they probably were right. I did sing in Spamalot, but it was sort of talking singing.
Well, when we have our reunion, because we keep talking when it's safe and everyone's in the same city, we're talking about having some kind of get together, and we would love to see you as well, you and your lovely,
lovely
wife.
Oh, I'd love to join you guys.
Yeah,
thank
it was
you.
So nice catching up with you and seeing you, and all your accomplishments are just very admirable and amazing. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks, Rach.
We have, and hopefully we've got more coming up with Caleb. We've got a lot of juicy storyline coming up with your character. So if you come back, we'll have you.
All right. Thank you, darling girls.
Thank you so much for listening. Follow, rate, and review Welcome to the OC Bitches wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you like to watch us, check it out on YouTube or on HBO Max. Please leave those reviews and let us know more about what you want to hear.
Shopify presents cool sheets from AHA to... I suffered from the wrong kind of hot in bed, heat-induced insomnia. That was my aha moment, bed sheets that keep you cool. Then I thought, how do I even sell bed sheets? That's when I had the idea that made it all possible, signing up on Shopify.
This is Possibility, powered by Shopify. Sign up for a free trial at shopify.com/podcast22. Shopify.com/podcast22.
Hi, everyone. It's Rabia Chaudhry.
And I'm Ellen Marsh.
And we have a new podcast called Rabia and Ellen Solve the Case. As you know, I am a very smart lawyer.
You are. You're so well-respected in the entire world. You know everything.
Thank you so much.
And as you know, I am a famous Broadway star. Gorgeous. I sing like a nightingale.
Well, yes. At least that's what your mom says. Just kidding. This is Ellen Marsh.
And I'm Rabia.
But we are teaming up to bring you a show like you have never heard before.
True crime meets talk show. Nobody's done it. We're going to do it. We're going to do the impossible. And it's the two things that I love. Ellen, I think you'll like it too.
What? True crime and talking?
Yeah.
I'm there. Every other week, we will have a guest talking about whatever true crime case they are obsessed with. We have a list, everything from the Lacey Peterson murder.
Yeah, some of the most famous cases you've ever heard of, obviously, like JonBenet Ramsey, the West Memphis Three.
Chris Watts, Khalif Browder.
Elisa Lam, Madeleine McCain.
Sandra Bland, the Springfield Three. The list goes on and on. But they are all cases that you know, and we are going to dive in deep with someone else and just talk about them.
No. We're going to solve the case, Ellen.
That's right. We're going to solve the case. So subscribe to Rabia and Ellen Solve the Case wherever you get your podcasts.